Hi, everybody. Great to see you all here. Great to be in Chicago. I was here a few months ago. We're on a national tour, as the speakers have said before. It's going to be at least 30 cities by the time we're done in May, and perhaps it'll even be larger because we've got to try to reach tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions with the truth. Not just myself, not just the Party for Socialism Liberation, but the coalition that we've been involved in with the people who, for example, the journalists who are going to be with me on April 20th for a nationwide live stream webinar to talk about the truth, to counter the media lies, which are extremely fierce. And I will talk a little bit about that. And people are saying, I don't trust the United States. We've had so many wars and media lies and pretexts. But the war in the media is so fierce that people don't know what to make of it. Fantastical, hysterical coverage. So that's what we're here about. You might have gotten a sheet at the door. It's a list of progressive media that we suggest that you can follow in English and Spanish to read alternative news about Venezuela, as well as Liberation News, which is our latest issue here, that says U.S. hands off Venezuela. I went to Venezuela from February 12 to March 12, and I actually had to fly to Cuba a few days before to get a visa, because as you know, on January 10, President Nicolas Maduro was inaugurated. And the aggression against him and Venezuela in this new period didn't just begin when he was inaugurated, although that was the tipping point for these last months. It happened just before his election in May 2018. Because when you look at the history of Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution, they've had 23 national referenda for president, re-election for president, for the parliament, for the governors, mayors. And out of 23, the Bolivarian forces have won 20. And with these elections, they've advanced in the social progress, the political progress, the constitution, for example, that was a referendum, overwhelming approval of the first constitution in Venezuela's history that was drafted and ratified by the people with a constituent assembly. So this time, because the U.S. feels like it's losing its grip in Latin America, notwithstanding the fact that in the last few years there has been a turn to the right in Ecuador, and with all these governments that the U.S. has lined up against Venezuela in the new formation called the Lima Group. But essentially, Venezuela is out of their grip. And so with this last election of the president, Nicolas Maduro's re-election, the U.S. decided we're not going to recognize this one or any other future election because we keep losing it. And so they instructed the opposition, you're not going to run this time. We're going to boycott it. Some did, though, including one person, Henry Falcon, who disobeyed U.S. instructions. And so the U.S. was not able to do what they wanted and say, only Maduro won. I mean, he's the only one who ran. Therefore, it's illegitimate. He's a dictator. They still say he's a dictator. And yet he won the election with 67.8%. But the inauguration for this second term was January 10, this year, even though the election was May 20. And the U.S. began its propaganda and its aggression. Between January 10 and January 23rd, the U.S. media and the government began to issue these warnings against Maduro. And on January 22nd, Mike Pence, vice president, met with or spoke by telephone with this unknown Juan Guaido, who's part of the National Assembly that has been declared null and void in Venezuela. And he was given instructions, told by Pence, tomorrow's the day. You're going to do this. He appears on television. Even people of his own party and the other opposition parties didn't know what he was going to do because it came from Washington. And he said, I am the president of Venezuela. This outrageous move by the U.S., but the allies of the U.S. in Europe, Canada, the liberal Justin Trudeau, the Lima Group, all these governments said, we recognize the interim president. Why, they'll use the Constitution, and if you read the article that he referred to saying he had the right to name himself president, it's completely false. It has nothing to do with what he did. And so that's the story of what's been happening. So it became very intense. As soon as Guaido called himself president and the U.S. said we recognize him, the government of Venezuela, President Maduro, said we are cutting off relations. We're ending relations with the United States. All the embassy and consulate officials left except, you know, one or two in Washington, and that's why I had to fly to Cuba to get a visa to get into the country. And I was there for one full month. People are asking, are people really going hungry? Is there really no food in the stores? No. You can see other journalists like Max Blumenthal, who did the filming on the internet and shows stores packed with food. Every store. There's not a shortage. The big supermarkets, huge, kind of like Safeway or whatever your local store is here. Fresh meat. Everything you need. In the neighborhoods, they have the bodegas, the smaller stores. They have food, too. And when you walk down the streets of Caracas or in the country where I went, travel westward, there's a lot of vegetable and fruit vendors. A lot. The problem with the food is in the supermarkets and the private stores, it's very high priced. Very high priced. The minimum wage right now is 18,000 bolivares. Maduro has raised the minimum wage several times, but every time it's raised, the private industries, the stores, because Venezuela's about 80% of the economy is capitalist held. They jack up the prices enormously. So what the government has done in the last 3 years is the CLAP food distribution program. CLAP, I have a little short video here, which I'd like to show. What I'm doing today is I'm going to show some video pieces as I'm going along so you can see it. I have heard about this, I've read about it, I've seen it in Twitter, but to see it in action is very impressive because 6 million families, meaning probably 3 to 4 per family, meaning 20 to 24 million people out of a population of 30 million get the food on a regular basis. It was when I was there monthly, and then I went to a parish of Caracas where in the whole country, everyone was asked in these distribution committees, really the communes and the communal councils, the neighborhood organization of the men and women, taking care of their needs, organizing the community, which Maduro says they're going to be given more power. We're going to have more of a government of the street, of the people themselves. Anyway, I was there one night when I was invited to the parish of Antimano. You'll see them featured in my videos. And everybody was asked, redo the census. Make sure and update how many families there are, how many members in the families, because we're going to double the distribution from monthly to every 2 weeks, every 15 days. 6 million families get the food. They're big boxes. I have a lot of video of one woman, for example, showing me everything she got. It's not here. You'll see other things about it. But just quickly, the box, general box that I had seen for many families was about 6 pounds of rice, 3 packages of pasta, a big bag of lentils, black beans, 2 liters of cooking oil, tuna fish, condiments, arepa flour, 2 big bags, flour, sugar, all the staples that a family could use. And they also distribute meat, 1 chicken, a roast, and 30 eggs, and you can see the price here. So with a minimum wage of $18,000 and the whole package of the collab for $1,500, that's affordable. And that's why people aren't starving, because the government has stepped in to counter the economic war and to counter the control by the big importers like Bolard, Nestle's, Procter & Gamble. Is that the government is doing this, along with the people's organization. And so people aren't starving. I was on a national TV, I was on three national TV shows, one very popular at night, Con el Mazo Dando. And I said to people, because we were in the street, myself and Silvio Rodriguez, and people were saying, why are you filming? Who are you filming for? They're kind of suspicious, because they've seen so much negative coverage in the U.S. And I said that night on TV, so if you see me in the street, please understand that I'm trying to bring back the truth and counter the lies in the U.S. media. So the next day, a woman came up to me, looked very, very nicely dressed, pearl necklace. She looked like she was from the upper class. You know, she walked up to me and said, I saw you on TV last night. And you need to tell people this. We're not starving. We're not going hungry. She was so insistent. She said, yes, we have problems, but we'll solve them ourselves. Yes, we have difficulties, but we're not starving. She said, you know, it's ridiculous. My daughter lives in Spain. And she called me and said, Mommy, are there dead bodies in the street? And she said, I was so mad at her, I had to hang up on her. So people were telling me that. So let's see that little video. It's subtitled, so I hope you can see it. Is there a way of making it bigger? It's important to know that we're not painting a picture of no problems. There are difficulties, definitely difficulties. And the sanctions did not just begin in January or when you've been reading it in the media. It's been an economic war. It's been the economic sanctions, which are intensifying right now. Do you know that last night, how many of you read the New York Times article about Venezuela and Cuba last night? It was posted late. But yesterday, the Trump administration imposed sanctions on 34 ships that deliver oil to Cuba regularly from Venezuela. And this means that the U.S. is preventing the oil, this years of exchange between Venezuela sending oil on a regular basis and Cuba providing what is now 24,000 doctors in Venezuela. It's part of this great idea, an ideal that was started in 2004, called by its acronym ALBA, A-L-B-A, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas. This was Venezuela's and Cuba's answer to the free trade agreement that Bush was trying to pass in 2005. Or he went to Argentina at the Summit of the Americas to try to impose on Latin America. But the ALBA ended up being Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Caribbean countries, Bolivia. And there was also Brazil and Argentina, which had relatively progressive governments. They weren't in ALBA, but they worked closely with the government, and they were on a friendly term. Now we see a country like Ecuador, with a right-wing president, Lenin Moreno, who is moments, I don't know if it's already happened, of Julian Assange being expelled from the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy, and the British are going to arrest him, and he may end up in a U.S. prison, never to be seen again. But we're going to fight that, right? We're going to fight and say, free Julian Assange, the whistleblower who helped expose the war crimes of the United States, along with Chelsea Manning, who's also still in jail. Anyway, so this is why we have our alternative media and whistleblowers, but they want to shut down the truth for their wars. But anyway, this is what ALBA was. And so this is what the U.S. is trying to destroy. The sanctions that were imposed yesterday on Venezuela to keep it from having its own relations and sovereignty and independent relations with Cuba cut off. I don't know what's going to happen in these next days, but we have to stand up not only for Venezuela, but for Cuba, for Nicaragua, which is also a target, for all Latin America, for the peoples of the world. We have the greatest obligation of any people in the world because we live in the United States. In the last few days, there's been instances where Venezuelans from the opposition, and 99% of the Venezuelans in the U.S. are in the opposition. And they moved here years ago because they had the means to do it. Some the other day were students whose parents had the money to pay out-of-state tuition, and so they could send their kids here. People were saying, you have no right to speak. You don't live in Venezuela. You're not from Venezuela. Oh, yeah, we have not only the right, but the duty, the obligation to speak out. U.S. foreign policy and domestic as well. We have the greatest obligation to fight U.S. imperialism. But anyway, that's the situation that Cuba and Venezuela face. This is very serious news. And the U.S. said, and the measures are going to continue, the tightening. Last November, John Bolton was named the National Security Advisor, this fascist, this madman who wants war with North Korea. When he was asked about North Korea, what to do about North Korea, he said, no North Korea. He wants war with Iran. You know, enough said. But he said in November, he coined the term the Troika of Tyranny, meaning Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. And we're seeing the unfolding developments now. They're not kidding in terms of what their intention is. And then in February, late February, before that ridiculous show of the humanitarian aid farce at the border with Colombia, Trump, in preparation for that act, which was February 23rd, he appeared on TV with Miami, in Miami, with right-wing Venezuelans surrounding him. And how many of you saw that speech? How many of you remember what it was? He said, there will never be socialism in the United States. I mean, emphatically. And I thought, that's interesting because there's more interest in socialism than ever, especially among the youth these last 2 years. And we've seen the growth of people who say, we know what capitalism is, we live it in the United States. And he also said, we're going to get rid of socialism in Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. So this is what's happening. In the last month, Trump has said that he will impose fully the Title III of Helms-Burton law. How many of you know what Helms-Burton is? I just would like to know what people are aware of. The Helms-Burton law was signed into law by President Bill Clinton March 16, 1996. And it was a severe tightening of the blockade against Cuba at a time when Cuba was trying to resist this what they call the special period, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the loss of their trade, and trying to find means, which they did successfully, means of new sources of income, foreign investment, a whole array of economic changes to survive that crisis. And the Helms-Burton law internationalized the blockade. But there was one part of the law that the U.S. presidents up till now have suspended because they knew it meant very negative consequences for their allies if they were going to impose it. What does Title III mean? And it's in Liberation News, the story. It says that any U.S. citizen or corporation can sue any entity in the world, corporation, individual, who invests in Cuban property that used to belong to the United States. And when you consider that most of the wealth of Cuba belonged to the United States thanks to their theft, and then the rest of it was owned by the rich Cubans, many of whom are now U.S. citizens, and that Title III says it applies to citizens who became citizens who may have been Cuban before, retroactively. In other words, it says, I mean, anybody who invests in Cuban property can be sued and their property taken away in any country. So it's a disincentive to invest in Cuba. All of this is a very serious attack on Cuba and Venezuela. So I'm talking not only about Venezuela today, but about what it means regionally and why we have to be very aware and updated about this. So on February 23rd, when the U.S. so-called humanitarian aid was supposed to come into the border, cross Colombia, and be received by people who were starving, I went and I took a bus about 25 hours to Táchira State at the border. And I was there with people from the Ministry of Penitentiary Service. They had a bus and I got on the bus with them. More about that later, because I visited four prisons in Venezuela. And we were there for the day. There were three bridges, but two principal ones that we stood our ground. And I was on the one where there was less violence from the right wing. But in the other bridge, you may have seen scenes about it. It was the Simón Bolívar Bridge, and it was pitched battle for 15 hours. There were dozens of Bolivarian people who were there to protect and be along there, alongside the militias, civilian militias, and the Bolivarian National Guard to keep both the terrorists who were loading Molotov cocktails and tossing them all day long at our side in Venezuela. And there were four U.S. tractor trailers with this supposed aid. The U.S. said in their press that they were going to bring 70 tons of food and aid. But as one leader in Venezuela stated just before the event, he said, 70 tons? He said, in that region alone, we deliver on a regular basis 12,000 tons of food. So it was a symbolism of the U.S., but the real objective was to see if they could split the military and get a large number of defections so that they could get those defectors and use it as a way to say, we've got the military on our side. That's been their big problem, you see. You've seen for weeks and weeks, the U.S. official said, you have a last chance, defect. They're weak. He doesn't have the support. There's people we're talking to on the inside. And then at that same speech that Trump gave in Miami, he said to the soldiers, to the armed forces of Venezuela, you have one last chance to come to our side. Because if you don't, you will lose everything in your lives. How many defected on that day? Some people crossed over. They crossed over into the border. Narco Rubio promised them $25,000 each. They really thought they were going to get it. And out of three, they really did. 300,000 soldiers and officers of all the armed forces, and 300 approximately defected. A very small percentage. The U.S. failed. That show failed completely. And what happened to some of those GIs? Because they were rank and file. A lot of National Guard. How many of you saw what happened to them? Anybody know? They had a press conference. Some of them were gathered at the border through an iron, fence. And a woman reporter from Venezuela put a mic through to hear them. And they said, we've been told we have 4 days to leave the hotel that we're housed in. We were given 300,000 pesos. I think it's a very small amount. And they said, and we were given a colchón. It's either a mattress or a foam, some sort of cushion to sleep on. And they're on their own. And they said, we have no family. We don't have family in Colombia. We're Venezuelan. And one guy said, President Guaido, we need your help. Didn't you learn your lesson? You just got used. You got spit out like a scab. But it's pitiful, you know? This is what the U.S. is doing. And why? With our alternative media source, I urge people to read it. Now, on that day, February 23rd, it was successful. We stopped them. The National Guard, these young men and women who were just enveloped in tear gas all day. I mean, it hit us too, but they were in the middle of it. It's what they had. It's what they used to keep the forces back of these terrorists. 300 people were injured by the rocks and by the Molotov cocktails. And what else happened that day? Two tractor trailers burned, right? You saw that they burned to the ground. And the U.S. and its allies and Luis Almagro, the puppet leader of the Organization of American States, they all said, Nicolas Maduro is trying to starve his people. That he burned the trucks himself. I mean, you know, they keep accusing him of doing these dastardly things against his own people. And it went on and on, that media coverage. He burned the trucks himself. He didn't want the aid. Well, we know now, if you read the New York Times and it was spread on the internet, that New York Times, amazingly, did an investigation. They managed to get a hold of the video that the Colombian government refused to release and show that there were several minutes spliced out to make it seem like all of a sudden they caught fire and that the government was responsible. It was the terrorists throwing the Molotovs. They made it catch fire. But on that day also, it turns out that a number of, probably about 30 people, terrorists with plots to assassinate, to use weapons, paramilitaries, made it through the border from Colombia who had been trained. Guatemalan, Honduran, Salvadoran. With the knowledge of the, with the support of the Colombian government, of course the CIA, and they brought in weapons. It's the article that, I don't know if it got handed out, an article that I did about this terror plot that's been uncovered. Yes, that paper there. Please do read it, because this is one of many, many plots against the government and the revolution itself and the people. And the reason it was possible was that there's all these little roads, these paths, even though the bridges have been closed, there's thousands of these paths that permeate the border. They're called trochas. And it's also the reason why billions of liters of gasoline are stolen from Venezuela, the subsidized goods, and taken over by black marketeers, contraband, and sold in Colombia for a profit. It's a very serious blow to their economy. That's another part of the economic war. I have a video I'd like to show. This is a woman, a very courageous woman. She's the Minister of Penitentiary Service in Venezuela. She is the one largely responsible for the amazing reform, radicalization, and humanization for those who are imprisoned in Venezuelan prisons, from the nightmare that it used to be. But anyway, I interviewed her the day after the victory of stopping the U.S. Trojan horse from coming in. And when she refers to the victory the day before, that's what she means. But she explains about the contraband. Now, it's all in Spanish. And some people might want to stand by the side if you want to see what she's saying, because it is all in Spanish. So I'd love for you to get the message. There's a little video of a man I interviewed on the street, too. So it's called bachaqueo. That's a word they use for the contraband.
Estaba explicando lo que es el bachaqueo aquí en Táchira con cuestión de la gasolina.
Sí, bueno, el bachaqueo es una palabra que se acuñó para identificar a un delito que se comete con los productos subsidiados del pueblo venezolano. Venezuela siempre ha tenido una política muy grande de subsidios para que el pueblo venezolano pueda acceder con facilidad a los insumos, a los bienes, a los servicios, al combustible, que desde que yo tengo uso de razón se ha llevado bandas organizadas de Colombia para allá, para surtirse. Incluso está el descaro que en Colombia sacaron una resolución y allá legalizaron el contrabando. Las estaciones de servicio que uno veía allí eran los pimpineros. Contrabandear el combustible y los alimentos y los productos sucios de Venezuela que transportar droga, decíamos nosotros. Y las amenazas, y bueno, lamentablemente el señor Donald Trump, en un acto de esquizofrenia, salió a dirigir él personalmente toda esta operación contra el pueblo venezolano, y lo que lograron fue despertar nuestro patriotismo, ¿no? Que en realidad nunca ha estado dormido. Nosotros los venezolanos somos patriotas, y por nuestra patria estamos dispuestos a ofrendar la vida. Decíamos antes del episodio de ayer que nosotros nunca nos imaginamos que íbamos a tener la gran oportunidad de vivir lo que se vivió aquí hace casi más, bueno, hace más de 200 años, que tenemos de independencia, que es tener que salir a enfrentar nuestra patria contra imperios, así como lo hicimos hace 200 y más años contra el imperio español que dominaba estas tierras. Hoy los hijos de Bolívar y de Chávez salimos nuevamente a plantarle cara al imperio. Con nuestro corazón de patriotas nos paramos en esos puentes, hombres, mujeres y niños de todas las edades, y estamos dispuestos a ofrecer nuestra vida. Gracias a Dios, aquí estamos sanos y salvos y cantando Victoria Popular.
Victoria Popular.
I have another little video here, if you'd like to see it. It continues, it's just short.
There are many benefits that the Venezuelan government provides to the people. We're here in a park in which you can see what is called a street gym. At 6 a.m., the weights are opened up and people can exercise for free. There are quite a few of them in Caracas and around the country.
No soy madurista, no recibo caclas, no recibo bonos, pero voy a dar mi vida por mi patria si me toca hacerlo. Por mi patria. La bala de los que nos están invadiendo no traen una varita donde diga, vamos a matar solamente a Chavita y vamos a dejar al opositor vivo. No. Entonces para yo morirme debajo de un sótano asustado, por una bomba, prefiero morir matando, por morir peleando por mi país.
I put him in because it was just very interesting to see them there. They would be there till midnight, you know, lifting weights. But he said, "I'm not a Madurista. I don't follow Maduro, but he's a patriot." And there's a lot of people who say that they don't want war; they want peace. And you see the right wing wanting war, asking for U.S. troops. I went to a right wing protest. It was probably 5,000 to 6,000 people to greet Guaido as he was coming back from his tour in Latin America. And the U.S. was, I think, hoping that he would be arrested because the government said, it's illegal what you're doing. You're violating the law by having left. But when he came back, nothing happened to him. I went to the protest. My friends said, Gloria, don't go. You're at risk. They saw you on, that you were on TV, and I said, but they don't watch those shows. So, yeah, nobody recognized me. I was interviewing people, and the vicious nature of the right who go to these protests was amazing. I would ask people, well, what do you think about the possibility of U.S. military intervention? Well, bring them. We want the troops. Well, I've been to a war zone in Yugoslavia during the bombing. And a lot of people die. I've seen people die in Iraq from the sanctions. Let people die. We need to change this. You'll see some of these tweets in Spanish. Someone who said the other day in a major paper, opposition paper, who said, we're going to have death. We're going to have death. So this is the nature of the right wing, and the people who want peace are willing to defend it with the militias, with the military, defending their country. I will talk about the electricity blackout before I end. I was leaving on March 7th, 7 p.m. flight to Washington, D.C. to make it for the great march in Washington. And it was 10 to 5, I was at the airport sitting down on the floor, and all of a sudden the lights went out. Just at that moment, before we lost all cell phone, everything, Richard Becker from San Francisco called me and said, the whole country is down. And I thought, this was a shock, to know that the whole country had no power. And I managed to get a cab home. You don't know how dark it is to have pitch black, no electricity except the cars. And I was all night wondering, are paratroopers coming? Are they going to surround the presidential palace? Are they going to try to kill President Maduro? Because there's been 4 attempts so far. And it was very worrisome. I'm sure a lot of people wonder what is happening tonight. It was very calm. The next day, you know, I woke up at 7:30, took a moto taxi to the presidential palace to see what happened. And they had a little TV in the office. Yeah, they had power. They had to have power. And the Minister of Communications, Jorge Rodriguez, said it is terrorism. It is a terrorist attack. It's sabotage. The lights went on for 1 hour at 3 p.m. We didn't know it would be 1 hour, but they went down again at 4 until the next morning, 9. We marched. There was no metro service. It's an extensive subway service that's free, by the way. It's free. But tens of thousands of people came to march, and a lot of friends said this is the largest we've had in years. The resistance, the courage. And then the power went out for 30 hours. When there is no power in Venezuela, there's no water. Because you need the water pumps to deliver the water into your faucet. And so when the lights went out, there was no water except if you had a bucket. With 4-5 days by the time I was able to leave, it was a very serious situation. And the hospitals were also affected. In the first day, Maduro had generators delivered to every hospital. I visited one, and the director assured me, he said, we didn't lose anything. We have all the power on, no operations were stopped, no services were stopped, but there were some people who died. Diosdado Cabello, who is the vice president of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, he said several people died because in the time to switch over to generator power, even though the doctors and nurses had to, you know, manually pump or oxygen or whatever they had to do, some people died. That's genocide. And that was U.S. generated, along with the terrorists and whoever the U.S. is paying, the paramilitaries, to try to make the people suffer. Why are they trying to make people suffer so drastically? Because power is everything. You not only have no communications, you can't even shop. There is another contraband operation, enormous, of the currency, the Bolívar. The Bolívar is their money, and it's very hard to find in the street because, again, it's stolen and it's taken for other operations by contrabandists. And, in fact, when I was getting my visa, the woman at the embassy in Cuba said, there's no money, so just be aware of that. Most Venezuelans have a debit card that they purchase things with. But they do like to have money, because it is their money, to buy things in the street where maybe they're, you know, someone's selling some little thing on a table and they don't have credit card service or debit service. And so I went to a fast food place, I went to buy a meal, and this couple behind me said, can we buy your meal on our card and you give us your bolivares? And then I went for breakfast one day, and then a woman walking by, it was like a little open shop, and she walked in and said, can I have your bolivares? I'll buy your meal. And the owner said, no, I need those bolivares. There are these things that people are having to make do with, having to get around, all this disturbance of the U.S. But this last week, there has been another sustained blackout. This time it was high-powered caliber bullets that were fired into the hydroelectric plant transformers of El Guri. There have been explosions, there's been terrorism against them. And yet every time there's an attack, like the coup that happened in 2002, when the people brought Chavez back to office, back to power,
and the people became more organized. Every time there's been a blow, the people have come out of it stronger. And just like what happened in the last week, the government is now forming a new body of a new minister for the power and electricity and water. The militias and the military are now working together with the electrical workers, heroic workers who have fought to restore the service. They're going to diversify the source of electricity to complete the other power plants that hadn't been finished. They're going to make sure that they're not going to suffer this attack. But Juan Guaido, on Monday, when this latest attack, a week ago, he was at the National Assembly that's been declared null and void. And did you hear him say, this will continue, the power will be out until Maduro leaves? He shows that he's part of it, and that's the plan. So when you hear the media say, oh, Maduro did it himself, oh, it's a lack of maintenance. Yeah, there's been problems with maintenance. That's not the cause of this. They keep blaming Maduro as if someone who's under the gun by the U.S. would want to make his people suffer so they could drive him out. I mean, why would he do that? Let's think logically. So sisters and brothers, along with what happened yesterday with the sanctions against Venezuela and Cuba with regard to the oil, let's keep... I'm glad you're here because we have to keep ourselves informed. Every one of you has a great job you can do with your friends, your coworkers. Someone said it's not easy to talk about Venezuela or say I support Venezuela with all this hysteria, but we need to do that. We need to break through it. Even if your friends or coworkers say, that's ridiculous, I don't believe that, that's not what I see, give them an article, print something out. But challenge it to make people wonder. And you don't have to be a socialist to support Venezuela's right to live. You don't have to say, I understand and I support President Maduro. That's not necessary. You just have to be someone who lives in our country, a human being of this planet, who says no war, no sanctions, no coup, hands off Venezuela. Do you want to watch one more short video?
Yeah.
About the housing mission? 2.6 million homes have been built at a nominal price for people to pay. Here we take 30 years, if you're lucky, if you can qualify or if you have a job that lasts that long or whatever, to buy a home for an astronomical price. There, people were telling me, I bought a home in a year, I bought a home in 2 years. And you'll see someone talk about it being a social investment. This is why the ruling class of Venezuela, hates the revolution so. Let's think about it. Real estate developers, what are they like here? They're building skyscrapers, right? The prices are just going sky high. I live in San Francisco. And everyone thinks, like, to get a home, I have to go into debt, just like to go to school. There, a home is a right. That's socialism.
One thing that came through in the videos that you showed, and also I think kind of the talk, but it's sort of the, I guess you call it the political consciousness of the Venezuelan people. They seem, in many ways, much more so than we here in the United States, aware of the stakes of what's happening and you know what side their government is on, know how the U.S. is part of this. I just wonder, where maybe, Gloria, you think that kind of comes from the Venezuelan people. Obviously, they've had a very unique experience. Maybe just how that's contributed to their understanding of their place in the country.
That's a very good question. You know, a lot of people would tell me, different people from different areas of work and the communities, would say that Hugo Chavez gave them back their history, that he taught them about their history and the pride in defending their country. And then they also said, we've always resisted. People said, like, we were not, it took 100 years for the Spaniards to dominate us. You saw the woman from the Ministry of Penitentiaries, of the courage of people. There's great resistance in the country. But I think a lot of it had to do with Hugo Chavez. Because for 40 years in what's called the Fourth Republic,
of the two parties, the Adecos and the Copeanos, you know, that they always, it was like the Democrats and Republicans. They had an arrangement from 1958 to share the power. Your turn, my turn, your turn, my turn. And the people got poorer and poorer. There's a very interesting fact. In the 1980s, there's a New York Times article, I wish I had printed it out, but it's from March 1989. And what had been happening for the days from February to March was that the president, Carlos Andrés Pérez, had raised all the prices up of essential needs for the people, 89, because of the demands of the International Monetary Fund. In Latin America, it was called the lost decade of the selling off the wealth of Latin American countries to satisfy this unpayable debt. The same thing had happened in Venezuela. But what happened in Venezuela with the raising of the prices was that people came out in rebellion in Caracas. It's called the Caracazo. That's the beginning of the modern history of Venezuela. And there were an estimated, they say that at least 3,000 people were murdered by the police, by the army. They just gunned people down in the street. And I met people who were alive at the time and who would tell me where they were at when it happened. It was severe repression. In the military, Hugo Chavez had been a young man. He had joined as a 16, 17-year-old, and he became this leader of a secret group inside the military of men like him that he had inculcated with this idea of revolutionary struggle and consciousness, of rescuing their country from what it had become. And when the Caracazo happened and this repression because the people couldn't take it anymore, he said, we need to speed this up with his plans. So 3 years later, on February 4th, 1992, he took a small group of men, four tanks and a truck, riding down the main avenue to the presidential palace to take on Carlos Andrés Pérez. At the end of that day, he had to surrender his, you know, he had to surrender because his men were getting killed, because they were not going to be able to get very far. But he said, I'll surrender, and I'll tell my men to surrender, he told the government, but I need to do it on TV. He got on television, and he said, I take full responsibility for this, and I'm asking my men to lay their arms down for now. And that word for now, por ahora, became the clarion call for the people. And they heard that and said, he said, for now, this isn't over. He was put in prison right away. He was so popular that presidential candidates in the next election, the next year, had to say, because people said, free Hugo Chavez. He was like an instant hero to the country. They said, they would say, if I'm elected president, I'll free Hugo Chavez. He was freed in 1994. Can you imagine? The power of his rebellious act with a few men. And this is, you asked about the consciousness. It really awoke in people, this idea of righteous rebellion. And so he was elected president as a result of that act, his singular courage. And he used his years of presidency. They show his segments on TV all the time, on the state-run television. They show segments where he talks about socialism, about traitors. He says, you know, corruption, those who commit corruption, because there is corruption, they're traitors to the homeland. They're not just people who committed a crime, they're traitors. And we need socialism more than ever. And socialism means equality and justice. The rich here and there don't believe in equality. They don't believe in justice. They don't believe in equality because they think if we have equality, I have to give up some of my billions of dollars that I can't even spend in my lifetime. That's how they think, the rich. And that's how they think there. And he would talk to people all the time about the fight of the homeland of their heroes, Simón Bolívar, Rodríguez, Zamora, all the people, and himself. And he did more than just run as president and become this singular leader. He formed a party called the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, the PSUV, because he knew it had to go beyond him. And he would say that. And sadly, when he was diagnosed with cancer in 2011, he knew that time was short, even though he hoped he would live. But you see him when he's really sick, it's really amazing. As sick as he was, he never gave in to that. He was always teaching people. So people, he's a great, great, great symbol for them. He lives on. And the unique thing with Venezuela, unlike other situations in Latin America, when Rafael Correa's term ended, and he had made some great progress in Ecuador, the citizen revolution, he called it. But when he ended his presidency, a right-wing president comes in and dismantles everything, about to like surrender Julian Assange to the British and then the U.S. So Venezuela is a particular target because it is a revolution. It's not the same road as Cuba or the Russian Revolution or the Vietnamese or any other. Each one is unique. It's still a mainly capitalist-run country, but the government has a socialist orientation. The ministries are run by the government. The government has the power of the state. The armed forces, the police, all of them, they go to university to become police or army or Bolivarian National Guard, and they learn about human rights and the dignity of the people and socialism. So that's the consciousness that's been in people, those who support the revolution, and there are many who don't. You know, it's a class struggle.
Quería agregar algo.
Oh, yes.
Lula da Silva le tuvo mucho miedo a la palabra revolución. Ahorita está preso.
Yes. He says Lula, the former president of Brazil, he had a lot of fear of the word socialism, and now he's in prison. You said something very important there, because my friends in the PSUV and my revolutionary friends I was with, they said, you see, the good thing about Chavez and now Maduro is that they're within their government and the people in the ministries, except those who've been caught for corruption, but essentially they're all socialists. He hasn't made a concession. You know, sometimes people go like, why is he always negotiating with the corporations and the corporate heads and the bourgeoisie? It's a tactical thing. He has to have some of their cooperation at this point, hoping they don't like commit sabotage, which they've been doing, trying to keep the peace. But the government doesn't have capitalists in the government. They're socialists. It's very true what you say.
You could describe some of the prison reforms you saw in Venezuela and the treatment of incarcerated people there.
And then your question.
Can you expand a little bit more about the failures of neoliberalism in Venezuela in the 80s and the 90s?
Thank you for reminding me, because I was talking about the New York Times article. The New York Times article is in the days after the beginning of the Caracaso. And they say there's gunfire, police gunfire shooting people. But in the last paragraph it says, one article goes, I think from 1981, remember this was 1989 that it happened, from 81 to 87, the level of poverty grew from 22% to 56%. Think of those figures. Sisters and brothers, that's 6 short years. But the rate of poverty, millions of people were plunged into poverty to be more 56%, and it was higher later. It was from the neoliberal policies of the cuts in social services. It happened throughout Latin America and many capitalist countries in the world that the International Monetary Fund demanded restructuring. They were called SAP, Structural Adjustment Program. That's an old term. We don't even use it anymore. Neoliberalism is a word used now. Argentina sold off all its wealth. It privatized all its wealth. And then Hugo Chavez in 2005 helped rescue it by paying off the debt through the bonds that they issued and helped Argentina. Mexico is classic. 1982, the oil prices fall, and its debt doubled, and from then on, it just went into this whirlpool, this go downward in a spiral for the debt that kept increasing, the debt that kept paying back, and the debt that never
went down. And now the U.S. controls much of Mexico's oil reserves from years ago. It's the only thing not fully privatized yet. 1,700 industries, corporations, everything in Mexico was privatized in the 80s and the 90s. And that happened to Venezuela. So even though by law Venezuela's oil was nationalized even before Chavez, it really wasn't. It was being privatized. In fact, the bourgeoisie, before Chavez came in, they bought Citgo properties to help expand their investment and get more investment in privatization. They bought Citgo, and that's why Venezuela's revolution had Citgo and still has it, except right now it's in the U.S. hands. That was neoliberalism. The thing about the prisons was, when I was there, was I went to two women units and one men's prison in Táchira State. I was with the people from the ministry, and they said, you've got to interview Iris Varela. They said, you've got to, she's an amazing woman. And I did. I interviewed her at length about the prison. There were several massacres involving dozens of prisoners who were killed by each other and also by guards to put down the fights that were taking place. It was called the open regime previously. Open regime meaning anything went in the women and the men prison. The men, in some of the men's prisons, there was what they called PRAN, these gang leaders. It was complete gang warfare, narco-trafficking, casino, prostitution inside the prison, and collaboration with the guards. A lot of killing and death, a lot of repression. And the same even in the women's. A young woman I interviewed, I would love to show you if you want to see a scene of today, but I haven't made the video yet. I'm going to make a documentary. I have a lot of footage from it. I spent 5 hours in two prisons. But I interviewed this young woman who, in this new reform, and she said, I've been in prison for 6 years and 10 months. I was in before it was reformed. And she said, I had problems. It's why my prison sentence is a little bit longer. She said, because I had very bad conduct. I refused to work. And she would get involved in knife fights. That was common in the women's prison because they didn't have uniforms. They didn't have rules. It was just anything goes. And she said, we used to fight over clothes, and we had what we called coliseum, meaning gladiator fights. And she goes, we would get our knives, our blades, our whips, and we would have fights. And the one who won was the leader, the new leader. And they do this amazing military exercise. I call it military. It's like this whole amazing exercise. Like you look at it, you go, wow, how do they learn that? Now, and I said to her, it's like a military exercise. She goes, no, it's not military. It's cadence. It's what we do to become human again, to teach us how to comb our hair, to take care of ourselves, to be ladies again, to become damas again. And the way it used to be, the women describe it. Horror. And for the men, too. And I was with the men as well. They're gardening, they're working, they're making shoes, they're doing all kinds of stuff. There's women who are becoming luthiers, meaning guitar and violin. They produce violins and guitars, learning all kinds of skills to go out. And the recidivism rate is almost zero. The return to prison. And I walked into a class of all these men chanting and singing about socialism. No, I mean militantly singing about socialism. They're becoming newer people. They don't even call them prisoner. They say, we change that word. We call them people deprived of freedom. Meaning, it's your condition, it's not who you are. That's a little bit of it. So, if you all sign up, I promise, we can maybe have a showing of the film. It's exciting.